to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone, and I have something for you to say that's important. Spring's coming.
Yes, because we both saw robins this week in Iowa.
Yes.
So the birds know. The birds know. Actually, we dodged a bullet here this week. We were supposed to get 6 to 12 inches of snow, and we got zero.
Yeah, great. It was great, wasn't it?
It all went south of us, which is kind of weird, but not all that unusual. All right, Mom, what do we have in store for our listeners today?
Well, today we have what I call a page-turner. And it is a really interesting story. The author is Katrin Schumann, and the title is This Terrible Beauty. Now, it's a complicated story because it's about the Berlin Wall that went up, that the Russians put dividing Berlin after World War II. And these people are trapped, of course, on one side. They're trapped on the Russian side. And it's an interesting book. And the thing is, you have to realize that it's going to jump around a little bit because things are happening in Europe, and then the person goes to the United States and so forth. So anyway, but about the author, she was born in Freiburg, Germany, and moved to Brooklyn when she was 2. At age 11, her family moved to London, England, and she was awarded a scholarship to Oxford University and studied French and German literature and played ice hockey. She worked at British Sky Broadcasting in London and received a graduate degree in journalism from Stanford University before settling in Boston. She lived with her husband and growing family in Chicago, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco, working in various capacities, including at National Public Radio, where she was granted the Kogan Media Award. She has had a tremendous amount of experience in the world and doing things, and that you can tell that by this book. So we welcome you to Writers' Voices.
Katrin Schumann.
Hi.
And
hello to both of you.
Hi. And This Terrible Beauty is your second published novel, if
that's
correct. Yes. And it's like coming out any day.
Yeah, I'm actually having a little launch party here in Key West, where I now live, tomorrow, which is one day before it publishes, on Sunday, March 1st. It will be readily available.
Fantastic. And your earlier novel was a Washington Post bestseller, The Forgotten Hours, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And you've also published 5 nonfiction books, I understand. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Sure, yeah. So I actually trained to be a journalist, as you mentioned in summary of my background. It's always kind of fun to hear about myself, somebody else summarizing the things that they find interesting. But you mentioned that I had been to Stanford, and there was a period of time where I thought I would become a journalist, and worked for NPR for a little while and so on. And then I realized that really journalism and the competitive nature of that field, I wasn't really cut out to do that in terms of my personality. So what I discovered was that I was really good at collaborating with other people on book ideas and book projects. And a lot of people have great ideas for books, but aren't necessarily gifted at the writing part of it. So what I ended up doing was publishing a number of books, some of them under my own name as a co-author, and some of them actually I was a ghostwriter and I'm not named on the book cover. But I did that for a number of years, and it was really fun and satisfying, and I learned an incredible amount. And it was a really nice way for me to feel productive and engaged in the professional world while I was sort of in, not quite in secret, but at the same time also always working on my fiction, which was really kind of my number one dream to realize that.
At what point in your life did you know that that was your number one dream?
You know, I have always, always loved writing and been drawn to words. You know, I usually tell this funny story about I published my first book actually when I was six. It's a little cardboard hardcover, you know, illustrated. It's called something like How Mrs. Schumann Married the Farmer or Miss Schumann Married the Farmer, something like that. So even as a little girl, I just was just fascinated by storytelling. And then as a teenager, I would sit at my mother's electric typewriter and write horrible stories about girls and ponies and things like that. And then in high school in London, I loved English and I loved reading. And when I went to college, you know, college in England is quite different. And we have, at least back then, less broad array of choices in terms of what we study. So I very much focused on literature and translation. And it was only after that that I got to writing and developing the kind of writing muscles in terms of these long-term projects, these full-length books.
Wow. I'm looking at your website and you have two of your nonfiction books on there. Mothers Need Timeouts Too, and The Secret Power of Middle Children.
Yes, that's right.
Are you a middle child?
Well, yeah, I'm actually not a middle child. That was an interesting story because I partnered in writing that book with a middle child expert, Dr. Catherine Salmon, and she is renowned expert on birth order and in particular middle children, but she herself doesn't have kids and doesn't have a family. And so I kind of added in our partnership, I added that real life parenting, you know, anecdotal aspect to the story. So she supplied all of the research and the insights into the sort of science behind it. And I came up with the kind of real life stories of how it works out in our homes and families to have multiple children and in particular middle children. But it was funny because I do have a middle child and she actually is just like the sort of stereotypical middle children that we highlight in our book. And it was always kind of funny while I was writing the book because I think my oldest and my youngest were a little bit jealous.
So what is the stereotypical middle child like from your book?
Yeah, so
a kind of a middle child. I'm second of five. Does that count as a middle
child?
Yes,
that counts. Okay. Yep. Technically, that does count. So the kind of guiding principle in this whole theory is that the middle children are sort of squeezed because they don't have the spot of so preferential treatment of the first one who was on his or her own for a few years and got all that attention, or the last one who tends to be kind of the baby of the family and a little bit coddled. And so the middle children typically become quite independent and they have usually quite a lot of friends. They're really good negotiators because they have to figure out how to get what they want by negotiating versus just getting it through dint of getting parental attention. And they tend to be kind of justice seekers. Like they really care a lot about fairness and justice. And they are really good friends. They've got generous qualities because they're really used to sharing.
I think that
sounds like
accurate.
Somebody I know. Yeah, it sounds like somebody I know.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are exceptions to any rule. And in that book, we do look at lots of different middle children, both famous middle children, but also just in a regular family environment, there are kind of different dynamics that play out. But what the main theory of the book is that middle children have never really gotten the attention, even in the world of science and in books and so on, the attention that they deserve. And so we wanted to shine that spotlight on them.
Well, in one sense, I really was a middle child because of the five kids, there were three born very close together, three within 3 years, and I was in the middle of that.
Wow, yeah. So you're definitely learning to negotiate to get what you want and have yourself be heard. And
Yeah. I think as a child, I mostly just tried to be unseen. and get what I want just by being really, really good. But mm-hmm. I did break out of that later.
Yes.
So let's go back to This Terrible Beauty.
Okay.
Which is set, as Mom said, right after World War II in Germany, behind the Berlin Wall, although you are going back and forth in time and in place in the book. And I understand that you have, and as you know, you were born in Germany. Were you born where this book was set, or what's your family connection with where you decided to set this book?
Well, I was actually born in southern Germany, in Freiburg, which is close to France and Switzerland. But my father is a Berliner, and he lived in Potsdam, just outside Berlin. And in the summers, when he was a little boy before the war, he used to go on vacation with his family to an island in northern Germany on the Baltic Sea called Rügen. And, you know, it's a little bit maybe like Martha's Vineyard. It's the kind of place that people go to year after year, and it's beautiful. It's windswept with these grand old houses and miles of beaches, a really stunning island. And I had heard some stories about Rügen, but I had never been there, and it didn't really mean all that much to me until after the wall came down and my father and I went on a trip up there. This was a matter of weeks after the wall had come down. And I was just so struck by that experience. It was really extraordinary on multiple levels. First of all, because the wall had just come down, it was like a time warp. I mean, it was like going back to the 1960s or 70s, the houses and the facilities, just, you know, East Germany had become economically stagnant, and they just really didn't keep up with a lot of development, and things had kind of gotten a bit dilapidated. So on that level, it was really extraordinary to be reminded that this whole half of Germany had been kind of left behind. And then on the other hand, I was also really struck. I went with my father to this beautiful medieval square, and it was surrounded by cottages, these thatched roof cottages. And one of them, his great aunt had lived in it, and it was derelict. It had been uninhabited for a while. And we snuck in through the back gate, and we went into the house, into the living room, which was sort of full of trash and debris. And I remember in particular, I saw on the wall right behind they had this sort of iron fire pit with which they would heat the house, and they would heat always with coal because it was very inexpensive, filthy coal, brown coal. And there was this big brown or black stain on the wall behind the heater. And the wallpaper had crumbled off, and you could see layers of wallpaper. And in that moment, it just struck me that in this house had lived various families. And I thought about the women who had tried to make a home here, and the way they had first suffered under fascism for all those years under Hitler, and then had kind of embraced the change because the fascists and the communists were arch enemies. So a lot of people had embraced the new regime after the war. And I felt that I sort of felt the spirit of these women who were really only trying to live ordinary lives and make a home for themselves, and had just the same dreams that, you know, you or I might have, but through circumstances that were so far beyond their control, their lives took very different turns, and they had to make all sorts of difficult choices. And that this was really actually relatively recent history. So that kicked off my relative obsession with that history that I knew so little about, and I just started researching.
So I'm looking again at your website, and you have a lot of information about the research that you did, a lot of books that give more information about this time period, and also a map of the occupied zones of Germany. And one thing that I just hadn't really thought about, but we all know about the Berlin Wall, which divided East Berlin and West Berlin. Yeah. But Berlin itself was in the Russian occupied zone.
So it is truly a little confusing, because Germany was actually split in half, but Berlin, which was the capital back then and is again now, is in the eastern zone. So what the Allies did is the Allies, the U.S., the French, and the Americans took half of Berlin, and the Russians took the other half of Berlin. But that western part of Berlin was sort of like an island in the middle of Russian-controlled East Germany. And that's what people, I think, don't quite realize when they think about the experience of Berliners. So they were kind of like prisoners stuck in the middle of this totalitarian state.
And there was, the wall kept, well, primarily kept East Berliners in.
That's correct.
More than West Berliners out. But there's this great long border between the rest of East and West Germany. Was there a wall along the whole border?
There were various different types of perimeter, you know, barricades, and, you know, some of them, I don't think that there was a wall along the entire border, but there was a pretty massive inner German wall. And there was, you know, another odd thing is that for many years, that barrier was fairly porous. You know, between the end of the war and 1961, when they actually built the wall, the Germans were able to go back and forth. Even in the course of one day, they could be living in the West and go work on the East, or vice versa, or they could go to see a play, you know, in East Berlin or whatever. But what ended up happening is that as the East Germany became more and more totalitarian and took control of ownership of property and took away people's homes and collectivized all the agriculture and all that sort of stuff, people started to leave. And there was this incredible drain. Thousands and thousands of people were leaving every single month. And that is what precipitated the building of the wall, because, I mean, they called it anti-fascistic bulwark, meaning, you know, they sold it to the people as in order to keep the fascists out of the East, but in fact it was to stop that drain of workers and people from the East who were leaving in droves to have a free life in the West.
And was that when your father left?
He left after the war. What happened was, so he was 7 at the end of the war, and his father was taken by the Russians. He disappeared. They ended up finding out much later that he had died in a concentration camp that had been actually a Nazi concentration camp that was then taken over by the Russians and used by the Russians. And they lived in Potsdam, which was part of East Berlin. And he used to, as a little boy, bike across Berlin in order to go to the West Berlin schools, because his mother didn't want him to be indoctrinated into the communist system. So he traversed Berlin for all these years, all these miles to go to school. And then his mother ended up leaving in the early 50s because she wanted him to get a Western education, essentially. But, you know, they had to leave their home behind. They owned a beautiful little house, which they loved, and they just had to pack their bags and leave and go to West Berlin. And he remembers that, and he shared those stories with me throughout my childhood.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Catherine Schumann, author of This Terrible Beauty.
You know, we have no conception of what life would have been for those people. This book does give us a pretty good picture of it. It's just, it's unbelievable in how they survived. And, you know, I don't know. I thought it was very interesting. I really did.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think the story hasn't really been told very much, and I can understand why, of what the experience was like for your average German citizen to sort of to just make it through that horrendous war, when so many of the ordinary people didn't really fully understand what was going on, and then have to go through that experience of communism afterwards, which was different, but in a way equally inhibiting in their lives. You know, they were no longer able to make the same kind of choices and have the same sort of freedoms. And it was really kind of an accident of fate. You know, you just ended up by where you happened to live. You were on one side of the wall or on the other side of the wall. You know, it was by no, it wasn't something that you did that meant you ended up in one place versus the other. And I became interested in that kind of randomness, and looking at the idea also of, you know, guilt and redemption. You know, the Germans, they were so evil, so bad, and yet they also did suffer. I just felt like maybe we were ready to hear those stories about kind of a little bit more nuance in the history.
Right. That's good. I guess that's why this book was so intriguing, because you saw the other side. And
in any nation, the people are not never 100% behind what the government is doing, what the
armies
are doing.
That's right, yeah.
And some people stand up more, some people stand up less. We certainly have stories, and in fact we're doing a book next week, of people who lived under German occupation and were heroic, who stood up in ways large and small. But a lot of people maybe didn't really understand what was going on, but didn't really support it either, and were just trying to survive. And it's hard to sometimes, looking back on it, to sympathize.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's most people.
Yeah,
and most of us would behave the same way under the same circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really, really true. I mean, we like to think that we would do something, you know, we would sort of, you know, find a way to be heroic. But what I really was interested in looking at was picking a particular family that really isn't political. They live up in the north. You know, they're pretty simple people. They're kind of functionaries. They have a fish shop. You know, they're not even that interested in politics. It just isn't really a big part of their lives until it is, you know, until there's just no avoiding it. And what do you do then? You don't necessarily just get up and leave and, you know, you're sort of stuck. And so I wanted to really shine a light on that and ask that question about how do we redeem ourselves when we are a nation, as Germany was, a nation that had perpetrated such horror all throughout the world, and yet is largely, you know, so many of the people living there were really just living day to day and trying to have good lives. That's part of the reason why I decided to have the secondary character, Werner, who is Bettina's husband, why I really wanted to go into his head as well, so that we could see how a German like him, who really, to my mind, is kind of a regular guy, you know, not particularly unsympathetic, but not particularly sympathetic, but how somebody like that, who doesn't have a lot of power, can be seduced by the idea of power. And as the secret police in East Germany become more and more established, and this character, Vanna, finds that he actually has a role to play and he can feel useful and he is respected, you know, that's very alluring. Does that make him a bad person? You know, I kind of played with that a little bit to look at that gray area.
Right.
And
I'm not going to be a spoiler until the end of the book, but I was pleased by the end of the book.
Oh, good.
What's kind of interesting to me, though, is looking at the, and we won't go into this too much, but looking at the similarities between that and things happening today.
Yes, I've spent many years writing the book and you know, predated our current political situation. But I think that often in history, you know, we see history repeating itself in different ways. And I think as a writer, really what I'm at least always trying to do is not just tell a story about a particular person or a particular group of people, but tell a story that somehow reflects issues that are that other people will really be able to relate to in one way or another. So even though this story happens to take place in the 50s and 60s and largely in East Germany, I still really wanted people to be able to read it and think about, reflect on their own lives, their own choices, and their own political environment, and, you know, how they might react and back then, but also how are they reacting now, no matter what side they're on. So you try to make something that's historical feel alive and pertinent even to what's going on today.
And of course, the victors write history, and if the Germans had won, we wouldn't think that they had been so evil, probably, because the history would have been rewritten and it would have been written in a different way.
That is true.
And there are probably things that our own nation is perpetrating now that from some perspectives would be seen as evil. And mm-hmm. and how it will be looked at 100 years from now kind of depends on who has power over the next 100 years.
I think that's very true.
And I do think the Germans, people as a whole, the German nation, should deserve some admiration for owning the owning what they did in World War II and not trying to cover it up and forget about it and say, oh, it wasn't such a big deal, it didn't really happen.
Yeah, and I have to say, I think I have kind of an interesting perspective on this as a German. You know, I still am a German citizen. I actually only became an American 4 years ago. But obviously I grew up elsewhere. I grew up in New York and then in London. But I often thought about what it meant to be German. You know, I identified as a German, and my parents sound very German. They have strong German accents and I speak fluent German. So sort of always perceiving myself as a bit of an outsider, a bit of a foreigner. And even now here in America, you know, I feel I am now an American, but I feel kind of European because I spent 14 years in England. But as such, I thought a lot about what it meant to be German. And I remember, you know, my best friend when I was a teenager, her father wouldn't let her learn German in school. He was a British guy and he just hated the Germans and he didn't want her to learn German. And I remember, you know, she was my best friend. And I thought, well, does that mean that I'm bad? You know, have I done something wrong because I'm German? I think those questions are really kind of interesting. And I wanted to play around with that in the book.
So, Catherine, why don't you read a little bit from the book so our listeners can get an idea of this story?
Great, yes. I'm going to read a scene that takes place kind of early on in the book. And just to give you a quick idea of what the overall, what the book is about, it basically follows the story of this young woman, Bettina, who is a teenager at the end of the war, and her father, her mother has died earlier and her father has just died. And she's kind of trying to pick up the pieces of her life as the war ends. And she's a lonely young woman. And she does marry a man named Vanna, whom she doesn't really love. So in the scene that I'm going to read you, it's her 18th birthday, and it is the spring at the very end of the war. And they have a sense that things are coming to an end, but they don't really know what's happening. As dawn breaks, Bettina heads for the beach on her bicycle, her father's camera bouncing on its leather cord around her neck. The streets are barely lit by the cool pink of a springtime sunrise, and vagrants are milling about, half-dead soldiers sleeping under trees and on sidewalks. It seems as though the whole world is on the move as the Russians march further and further west, ever closer to them. Her father's last words to her as he lay dying had been, "Versteck dich, Bettinalein, promise to hide." Oh, but she can't, not today. She needs to see the ocean again. She can't stand being cooped up inside the house any longer. Bettina's willing to risk anything just to feel the sea breeze on her parched skin and taste salt in the back of her throat again. A few fishermen have detangled their nets, hanging them to dry between long sticks. Bettina lifts the camera and looks down through the viewfinder, taking comfort in clicking the dial till everything comes into sharp focus. She presses the button again and then again, even though the camera is empty of film. It's been years since she's been able to find 35 millimeter cartridges. After a while, she starts running just so she can feel the wind against her arms and her legs, her neck and her face. Her house dress flaps around her knees like wings beating against her skin. Close to the edge of the ocean, she runs as fast as her feet will carry her, clutching the rowlie in both hands. Tar-covered debris littering the sand makes her footing clumsy, but she jumps over the pieces of wood, the twisted scraps of metal. She runs until her side is pierced by a stitch and her breath comes in short, sharp bursts. And then, unexpectedly, her foot lands badly and she trips, falling spectacularly, flinging her arms out in front of her. Something wet nudges at her skin, and in horror, she jerks herself upright. It's a small dog, a ridiculous-looking mutt with yellow tufts springing from his ears. Bettina tries to stand, and a stinging pain courses up her leg. In the cove of trees not far from her, she detects a mound of fabric, olive green and filthy, next to which lies a boot. Dozens of Scotch pines, battered by wind blowing in from the north, stoop along the edge of the sand, gray and wizened. Crimped limbs have been broken by storms. It takes her a moment to realize the boot on the sand is attached to a foot, and a person is lying among the dunes in the shelter of the trees. The person stirs and sits up. It's a man, a soldier. Her body stiffens. This is what her father warned her about. She should have known better. Acknowledging what must be a look of terror on her face, the beachman lifts a hand and waves at her. A wave, a commonplace wave. No one waves at strangers anymore. Bettina struggles to her feet. Leaning heavily on her ankle, she winces. As the man rises and begins walking toward her, she attempts to back up. His uniform is stained in oily patches and torn at the seams, and around the sleeve of his jacket is a grubby white armband. Please, please, she stammers, backing away from him. Please, please don't hurt me. So I'll leave it like at that. She meets a very important person on the beach that day, and she doesn't see him again until a few years later, but he ends up playing a rather important role in her life.
Yes.
And that's Katrin Schumann reading from This Terrible Beauty. Tell us where the title comes from.
Well, for many years, the book had a different title. It was actually called The House of a Thousand Eyes, which is the nickname for the Stasi headquarters in Berlin. It's a big building that has a million windows. And so the East Germans would ironically call it the House of a Thousand Eyes because that's where all the spying happened and they were looking out, but you couldn't look in. And my publisher and my agent both agreed that they felt that that was not the right title, that it sounded like a horror movie, which had never occurred to me, to be honest, but God forbid, I don't want people to think this book is a horror story. And so we scoured the book thinking of appropriate titles. And I had used the term, this terrible beauty, in one of my scenes to describe the kind of stark landscape in Rügen, which this island that Bettina loves so much. And this terrible beauty is also a term that Yeats used in a poem when he's talking about the revolution against the British in Northern Ireland. And he's talking about the sacrifices that people make when they fight against the oppressor, that there's something kind of beautiful about it because you're fighting for your rights, but there's terror in it, and it's ugly as well because people die and it you know, these protracted battles over years for your freedom. So it seemed to me that contradiction really nicely summarized what I was looking at and the various themes in this book.
I agree. And it also, in this scene, your character is taking photos or pretending to take photos. And this, her love of photography is actually a pretty important theme throughout the book. And the title to me also kind of reflects that, because the way that she looks through the camera and the things, the way that she sees through the camera.
Yeah. So the camera was an interesting kind of development in the story for me, because as a woman at that particular time, there's no expectation that she's going to have a voice particularly. You know, she's probably, you know, under normal circumstances, she would have just been a regular housewife or worked in her father's fish shop. And but she has a perspective, and she has kind of a vision. She has a creative impulse, which she discovers through her father's camera and taking pictures. And it's something that allows her to feel connected with the world. And she discovers over time that she can use that voice, but she can't do it in East Germany. Her husband doesn't understand it. He thinks it's a stupid hobby, and he doesn't really get what she's doing. And she herself doesn't really fully understand it either, this impulse toward connection. And I found that there was some irony in this idea that once she's forced to leave her homeland, and that tragedy of her having to start a new life, but all on her own, it's when she's in that situation that she really discovers that taking pictures, it almost kind of saves her life, this ability to feel connected, even though her life has taken such a tragic turn. And then, of course, it doesn't end there. She ends up being quite successful and so on and so forth. But the camera is an important part of the story, and her trying to find a way to have some agency and have some connection with other human beings is part of that.
I really like the part in when she's in Chicago and she is photographing a civil rights, not exact kind of a riot, a demonstration, the way it is described, again, she's connecting with the people who were victims of oppression. And even though she was white and may have been considered an outsider, she was able to form that connection. And I really like how you described that.
I'm really glad you picked up on that, actually. It's so gratifying to hear when readers appreciate sort of a little moment in the book, because it's not a big part of the book. It's just one small scene. But there were actual race riots in Chicago at that time. That is real history. And Chicago was gentrifying and changing, and there were gangs, and you know, this was in the 60s. And so it wasn't as though America was, you know, all the land of milk and honey either. You know, the Americans were going through their own struggles. And so I thought it was really interesting to look at how this woman who is so clearly an outsider, I mean, she's a German, so she speaks with a very strong accent, and she hasn't grown up in that culture, but how she does feel connected to these people, because they're trying to find their voices too. And you would never really think that. Obviously, you would never think it just looking at them. But her circumstances bring her into contact with them. And when she's taking their picture in the aftermath of this riot, and she really does feel that human connection, as I think many of us do in unexpected circumstances.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Katrin Schumann, author of This Terrible Beauty. Katrin, I understand that you also teach writing.
I do, yes. I love teaching.
And that you teach in prisons, and you teach in an independent writing center, and you teach at workshops. And so tell us a little bit about some of these different places that you teach and how it may be different one from the other.
Sure. So most of my teaching centers around Grub Street, which is an independent writing center in Boston. It's the largest in the U.S., actually. And it's a really wonderful, innovative place, actually quite rigorous, but very, very welcoming. And that's where I cut my teeth on teaching before I had even published, actually. I've taught a variety of classes there, nonfiction and fiction. And one of the biggest things that I did was I developed, along with another author, I developed a program called the Launch Lab, which is for new authors to help them figure out how to promote their work. Because that's kind of this big, nebulous, confusing, slightly terrifying mountain that you have to climb once you publish, is that you have to get the word out there about your book. So I taught a really intensive series of classes on that. And that community really allowed me to professionalize and become connected to writers. They have an annual conference called The Muse in the Marketplace, which is fantastic. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in writing to check it out. It's actually going to be taking place in April in Boston this year. And then what happened is I'm not entirely sure why, but ever since I was a young woman, I had always thought that I wanted to teach in a prison. And I never had the guts. You know, I was just sort of, it was this idea that I had, but life got in the way and I just never did it. And then when I started working on my first novel, The Forgotten Hours, that centers on a story of a young woman whose father is sent to prison for a crime that she doesn't believe he committed. And that was a pretty tough book for me to write on a pretty tough topic. It's around a rape accusation, and it's looking at the issues of truth and loyalty and so on. And I thought to myself, you know, if ever there's a time for me to be brave and sort of get over myself, now's the time. And I signed up to teach writing in various prisons in the New England area through Penn New England. And that was a really intense experience on multiple levels. You know, writing this book while I was teaching in prisons was pretty interesting. And I do feel very strongly that if we give people the tools to tell their stories, and if we help them to articulate whatever it is that they're feeling or what they've experienced, that that's incredibly therapeutic and helpful. And that sometimes people do the wrong thing, you know, and commit crimes, and partially because they haven't been heard, and they haven't found a way to be heard in life. So that definitely felt real and true to me as I worked with these men and women who were incarcerated. And then I learned a lot about myself too, you know, my own fears and what it was like to be a woman and to go into these prisons and kind of, you know, I'm pretty much a girly girl, you know, and you have to really strip all that down, and you just have to be just a, you know, kind of asexual human being going in there, obviously. And that was just weird and interesting, and I think a learning experience for me. And then now what I do is I work here in Key West, where I'm based most of the time now, for a small literary nonprofit. And so I run workshop programs. I'm not doing quite as much teaching, but I bring authors to the island, and we have a week-long session series of 9 workshops that I manage. So it's all kind of come full circle. It's, you know, it's really, really kind of cool. I feel like all those years of hard work in anonymity when I was struggling in the early days, you know, not knowing what it was all going to end up looking like, well, this is what it looks like. And I can tell you, it's pretty darn great.
It's interesting. You do seem to focus not just on the writing, like you say, but also on marketing the work. I follow, you know, a number of people on Twitter, and one is a literary agent named Lauren Spellier, I think. Mm-hmm. And she just tweeted, the don't quit your day job advice was a lot more fair when authors weren't responsible for marketing their own books.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because there are so many myths around publishing, as I'm sure you know and have spoken about with other guests. But, you know, there's this idea, first of all, that it's glamorous somehow, and that, you know, you get a book deal and then you're flown all over the country and, you know, Raptors crowds come and greet you everywhere you go. And then you get a movie made about your book and it's all fabulous and you quit your job. And of course, you know, that's not really what happens. And there is definitely a mystery around what we're supposed to do in order to get our books out there. You know, I think it's odd in a way that the agents and editors don't focus more on helping authors figure out what is an effective way to reach out and to get readers to know about their books. You know, it's noisy out there. A lot of people have a lot of things to do, and there's a lot of stuff on our phones and on our TVs to watch and so on. How do you break through? It's just not that obvious, especially for authors who typically are kind of quiet and like to sit behind a screen, tapping away at their computer, writing stories in silence and alone. You know, it's absolutely.
And most of our guests come to us through a publicist,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a publicist that's hired by the publisher or by the author. And I'm not sure how many are of which, you know, which one.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's another thing that authors often don't know is that sometimes it's worth spending some of your hard-earned advance money on hiring your own publicist, because it's a confusing world out there. You know, where do you spend your time? What's most effective? It's not obvious, and it varies depending on what your goals are and what kind of book you've written. And that's not something that we just know instinctively. So publicists can be very, very helpful, but you got to find the right publicist too. You know,
absolutely,
because there's no guarantee that you're going to get anywhere with a publicist. You know, you might spend a lot of money and really not reach the readers you're trying to reach.
We do guests that approach us directly, as well as mm-hmm. ones that come through publicists and ones that come directly from publishing companies. But in sometimes it is kind of makes it easier for me if it's a publicist, because they're doing at least some filtering. The ones I worked with a lot know what kind of books I like.
Right.
And it's so there's an advantage there.
Sure. And, you know, at every turn, there are gatekeepers, basically. There are people whose job it is or who you know have vetted in some way, you know. And with self-publishing, there's a lot of great stuff out there, but there's also just a lot of material.
Right.
You know, there's just a lot of stuff and you don't have time to wade through a bazillion books, you know, that would turn up at your doorstep every day. So it makes sense that you make use of these gatekeepers, whether it's an agent early on in the process for writers or an editor at a publishing house eventually, or a publicist in your case, who helps you figure out what kind of books would be appropriate for you to look at.
Right, right.
This marketing stuff is not something that writers typically want to spend much time focusing on. And actually, one of the reasons I developed that whole course was because I hated marketing so much. You know, it was not fun for me. But my first co-author had been in marketing and she loved it and she was so good at it. And that's how I ended up on the Today Show, because she was just relentless and she knew how to pitch. And so I feel like I learned so much from that experience that saved me a lot of time and agony down the road.
Mom, I know you took a lot of notes on
this. Oh, yes,
book.
I did.
And part of it was to kind of keep track of things. Catherine, why did you decide on the structure that you used, which is going back and forth in time and place?
Well, originally, I did not have that structure in place. And what happened is over the writing of the story, there's this driving question that readers know from the very beginning of the book, which is, you know, does Bettina get her daughter back? And what will happen? And I realized that a lot of the scenes and the kind of more quiet drama that I wanted to expose that happens in East Germany, the kind of struggle of her early life, that was only, I thought that might only be interesting to readers if it was framed within this larger question of who is the man she married? Is he a good man or bad man? And ultimately, is she going to be able to get her child back or not? And so it seemed to me that the best way to do that was to show her in the present day, which is in the 60s, and kind of have these really, they're not really flashbacks because most of the book takes place in East Germany in the 50s. The portion that happens in Chicago is actually pretty small, but it is periodic throughout the book, so it's kind of a touchstone. I felt like that just added to that driving question and kept reminding the reader what the stakes actually were of the story, that this big question of whether or not she was ever going to be reunited, comes true or not.
Another thing that I liked about your characters is that they're not one-sided. There's many sides to each one of them.
Oh, and thank you. Yeah, that was on purpose.
Yeah, that's what makes this book so interesting, because that's life. That's reality. And but we don't always see that in people either, that we know. We don't realize that they have many sides to them.
That's right. And in particular, somebody like Vanna, one of the main characters, you know, it would be easy to dismiss him. Kind of, you know, is he this boring functionary? But, you know, no, there's more to him than that. And equally, there's more to Bettina than, you know, she's a flighty young girl who decides she doesn't love her husband. You know, there are complications to these stories. And when we're forced to make choices under compromised circumstances, you know, we sometimes make bad choices. And that's really kind of what this book looks at, how we're more complicated than it might seem at first.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, he is a hero at first, you know, the first thing
that's right,
that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I can see why she was drawn to him. That's, you know, it is. It's just a fascinating fascinating look at people. And of course, they were struggling through a very difficult time, and yet they kept their moral compass, I would say, in the end.
Yeah, well, that's the big question, really, in the book is what is the moral compass of these people, and are they, what will they do? And that question really, in a way, applies to Bettina too, as a mother. You know, mm-hmm. what will she do? Like, how much mm-hmm. is she motivated by what she wants versus right. what is the right thing to do for her child or for her family or whatever? And I thought that was that's a kind of a universal question that isn't just applicable to that particular story or that particular era.
That's right. Exactly.
So, Catherine, as you were writing this, did you write all of the Chicago part together, or did you write it interspersed with the part set in Germany?
Yeah, my writing process is pretty circular. So, not linear. I go from A to B to C to D, but then I might jump again and I might change things around. So my books change format, form, structure quite often when I'm in the process of putting them together. But I think my final edit on this book, because it used to be much longer too. It was, you know, significantly longer and had additional scenes. And there was just so much research that I was fascinated by that I was kind of trying to cram in there. And I think in the last edit, I had real clarity about what it was that I was trying to say in this book and what I really wanted to look at. And so I was able to go through and put the scenes in the right place, kind of marching through the story of the book. And it felt pretty natural to me to have those Chicago scenes turn up where they turn up, and kind of play off what's happening in the past in East Germany at the same time. That's a complicated thing for a writer, and also often, as you probably know, frustrating for readers, because you're kind of pulled from one thing to another. But the main thrust of the story does still happen in that era of the 50s in East Germany.
Right. I didn't find it distracting to be moving back and forth, but
I didn't either.
But it is, but you, as a writer, you're right, you do have to be cautious about that, because mm-hmm. you don't want to interrupt the flow of the story.
That's right, yeah. You need to make sure you're adding something valuable to the story and not just being fancy, you know, and technical and showing readers how special you can make something. It has to really add to the story.
Exactly. When you published your previous book, was it difficult for you to find a publisher, or was your path to publication pretty easy?
Well, I would say it was long. You know, I would say it was a long process. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that for me, and it's very different for different authors, it took me a reasonably long time to figure out how to write a book that was going to make readers want to keep turning the pages. So I think in the early days when I first started writing and trying to sell my work, my fiction, I didn't totally understand plot and how to write a story that's actually compelling versus just kind of interesting. You know, oh, that's interesting. That's not enough to engage a reader. The reader has to really want to turn those pages. So actually that first book, The Forgotten Hours, was a fairly controversial topic. You know, it revolves around a rape case, and I'm asking readers to live in this really uncomfortable place where they don't know who's the bad guy and who's the good guy. And, you know, they're kind of asked to have sympathy for a guy who's already been convicted and is in jail. And so I had a huge amount of interest from agents who thought the book was just, you know, hot stuff. And then it was harder when it went to editorial boards at various publishers. It was hard because they worried about that aspect of it. And at that point, Me Too had broken into a national conversation. And I think publishers were just kind of just treading softly a little bit.
Right.
You seem to want to show a kind of the sympathetic side of people that others may demonize. I see that commonality between these two books.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I think that actually goes back to what I was talking about a little earlier in this conversation, which is my being an outsider always. When I was a teenager in London, I know that people thought I was kind of cold and snooty. And really, I was just shy and uncomfortable. And so I understood that people were making assumptions about me that were incorrect. And I didn't really know how to change that. But I think that made me very sympathetic to understanding that people are complicated and they don't always seem who they are, and they're not always who they seem. And that seems to be a thread in my books for sure.
And that's a very good description of
terrible
beauty. And we're out of time. So Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. We all have at least two families, the one we came from and the one we create, both with joys and sorrows, and that is life, and that is evident in this book completely.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for being with us today, Katrin.
Well, I really appreciate it. It was a treat.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye.
Bye.